Welcome. We are Dave and Cece Roberts, and on this podcast, our desire is to connect our community through conversations about following Jesus by sharing our stories.
Stories are powerful because they can inspire, encourage, challenge, and connect. And we hope this story does just that. So as you listen, if there's something that resonates with you, send an email to the person sharing their story, which you'll be able to find in the show description.
Recently, I sat down with John and Emily DeYoung and had a wonderful conversation with them. It was filled with a lot of laughter, a lot of honest sharing. And the thing that stood out to me in the midst of the conversation was the friendship that the two of them have. They have been married for almost 30 years. They met when they were teenagers. Emily went out to Southern California on a mission trip and connected with John. And their story took off from there. And I love the laughter that we shared, but most of all, their hearts for Jesus. And I want you to really listen to all the way to the end, because they give us a really specific challenge for those of us who live in West Michigan. And so I'm going to start with John. John, why don't you share with us about growing up in Southern California?
I grew up in Southern California to a missionary dad. So my parents were missionaries to Mexico, and he had spent 40 years being a missionary in South America and in Mexico. So I grew up in a Christian family, and we read the Bible and prayed at dinner times, and we went to church twice on Sunday. So I was definitely brought up knowing Jesus and knowing the Bible pretty well by the time I got to college and marriage years. So
now that they say, you know, what's worse than a pastor's kid?
Yeah.
A missionary kid.
Yeah.
Is there any truth to that?
We had some struggles. There were some speed bumps along the way. It sounds like it went really smooth, and it necessarily didn't. So yeah, it was my childhood was a little different being a missionary kid, and like I said, there were speed bumps along the way. So I ended up leaving home when I was 17, and then I never went back, and then ended up getting married early, and that's where things went better.
things improved from there. Why don't you talk a little bit about, you can share as many details as you want, but at 17, what led you to leave home?
Relationships were difficult in our family. My father was brought up without parents. He was actually a gang member when he was young, and then became a pastor later in life and a missionary. And so he struggled as a kid. And I think some of that just reflected in the way family was done in our household. Mm-hmm. And yeah, when I was old enough, I felt like I was independent pretty young compared to nowadays where kids are independent. And when I was 16, I went out and bought a vehicle. I bought a panel van with an inch and a half shag carpeting on the ceilings and the walls, and brought that home to my mom, who was sitting there. And that's the first time I'd ever seen my mom yell at my dad. Said he let a 16-year-old boy buy a van with a bed in it. And what was he thinking? And so I had just bought my vehicle and my home. And when I was 17, I left.
Your vehicle and your home. That is a good question, and a legit question that every mom should ask, you know, of her husband. Like, why did you buy a van with a bed in the back for our 16-year-old?
It had a fridge, too.
It had a fridge. Good question, though.
So then I had already met Emily briefly before that, and left California and drove to Michigan here and got a job and worked. And that's when we started dating. Really, we had dated a couple times before that, but that was when our relationship started.
And yeah, Emily, before you get to your story, what did you think of the van?
Well, you have to understand that at that time in my life, I was so intrigued with my California surfer boyfriend because he had the cute blonde hair with a little swoop in it, and he was tan. and he knew how to dress surfer like. So that part attracted me more than his transportation choices at that point in my life.
Oh, so good. So you grew up in Michigan.
I did.
So talk to us about that.
Sure. So I grew up in Zealand with my mom and dad, and I have three other siblings. So there were four of us total. I was the second of four kids. And honestly, I had an idyllic childhood. We grew up playing wiffle ball in our backyard, had tons of neighborhood friends. We would go make forts in the woods after school. And it really was a fantastic childhood. My parents were also believers. So we grew up with a lot of church involvement. My dad was always the choir director at church, and he did a lot of singing. And my mom was always in women's ministry and leading Bible studies. And so Jesus was a part of my life too, from very early on. And even the church was also a really important part for my family. And I saw my parents' faith in action when my little brother, who's 3 years younger than me, was born. He had a congenital heart abnormality and had some really significant surgeries as a little guy, first as an infant and then when he was five. So I remember my parents throughout that time praying a lot for his health, and friends would come over and they would pray for Doug's health. And so I think in a lot of ways that shaped who we were as a family. And so I think looking back, I couldn't be more thankful for the heritage of faith that my parents gave me. My grandparents were also just kind of pillar members in the church that we attended. So I'm so thankful for a heritage of faith in my family. Go ahead.
Looking back, if you can remember that far back, you know, when your brother was born in the heart condition, what do you think that did for your faith back then, seeing like, okay, it wasn't just going to church, mom and dad doing that and engaged in church, and that's important in engaging people's lives, but, you know, seeing their faith in action. Mm-hmm. What did that do for you?
Yeah, so at the time when my brother was born, I was three, so mm-hmm. I'm not sure how much I remember from those years, but when he had a surgery, I was eight. And at that time, my grandparents moved in, and he was in Ann Arbor. He had surgery at the University of Michigan Hospital. And so when my grandparents moved in also, they were steadfast and they were confident and would say things like, we believe Doug will be healed. Mm-hmm. And so I think that shaped who Jesus was in our life early on. I can remember going to visit my brother in the hospital, and there were probably, I think, if I remember correctly, there were three other people in the world that had the same surgery that he did when he was that age. So it was really rare. And I think that it was very, very life-threatening, but there was a confidence that my grandparents and parents had throughout that time that really trickled out to me. And so just confidence knowing that no matter what, Doug is in the palm of Jesus. And so I feel like that shaped that, just that foundation for me too, in that foundation of knowing that no matter what happens, and I've done some really dumb stuff in my life, but no matter what happens, nothing can separate me from the love of Jesus.
That's so good. You know, I just admire that rock solid faith in the midst of adversity and trials and all of that. Just like, nope, our faith is in the Lord, and he's going to heal Doug. You know, that's mm-hmm. powerful. And so the two of you come from families that love the Lord, missionary family, and then a family that was really connected in the church. And talk to me about, like, when was the time that you two surrendered your life to Jesus? When you took that faith that you grew up with and like, okay, this isn't just something that my parents did. This is real to me.
I think mine would have to be after we got married. So we got married, I was 19, Emily was 20. She's quite a bit older than I am.
Nice job.
Yeah.
You and I both married older women. Good job. Uh-huh,
mm-hmm. It's actually a couple months, but we try to make it sound really bad. So we were really young, but even at that age, we became pretty involved in the church. We were youth yet, but we still were youth leaders for the kids that were just a little bit younger. And we connected well because we were basically the same age. So then we were pretty involved in the church then. And that was really where I think that I started becoming more about the faith being mine than my dad's and my mom's, and kind of my own, and starting to understand more. And then I think from there, it is just the more knowledge and the older I get and the deeper I understand things, it gets stronger constantly, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I'm thinking even for John, one of the ways that I've grown in my faith is just in partnership with him and watching him grow over the years. But, you know, for early childhood, I don't ever remember not loving Jesus. Like, I think it was just part of who I've always been. So even as a young girl, I loved Jesus. So I don't ever remember like a pinnacle moment where I had a transformative moment in my life. But I think in my early teens, I became more vocal about who Jesus was in my life. So back then there was a Luis Palau crusade. I don't know if you remember this in Western Michigan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And at that time they were looking for people who would pray with folks that came to know the Lord. Okay. And I think I was 13 or 14 at the time. And I wanted to volunteer to be on the prayer team for that crusade. And so my parents, of course, blessed that. And they encouraged me to be a part of it. And then when I was 15, I applied to be a kind of a summer missionary. And that's really when John and I met.
Okay.
So I went to California and we served at a church. Out of 180 sites that I could have been assigned to, I actually was assigned to the church that his parents served at. So it was definitely a God thing for meet at 15, 16 years old. And even though there was no dating allowed on Swim, he found a way to walk me home quite often.
No dating.
We weren't dating. Just walking slowly, talking.
Right. So we had a great summer. I spent the summer in California. Okay. And so got to know John and became mesmerized with my surfer California boyfriend.
So talk about, okay, John, you move out to Michigan in your van, your sweet van, and you guys date. Like, talk about that dating time, you know, let us into that a little bit. You know, what was that like? And then eventually you guys get married at, you know, 20 years old or whatever, and you're really young. What was that adventure like?
It was an adventure. You know, we had come here. I had come here and we immediately were dating, I think, at that point when I came back, and just living life, like actually more trying to stay alive, you know. So I was getting a job and working, and I would couch surf. So I would live by my grandma's or stay at her house or wherever the van was parked. You're there, you're home. And then we ended up going to Calvin together. So that was kind of the intro. And even more so, we were together in neighboring dorms. And so the dating just naturally progressed from there. And then I forget what year it was, our sophomore year, it must have been, that we got engaged. And we had talked about getting married, and you know, I was very independent at that point. I wasn't connected to my family very much at all. She was less so. I mean, she was very connected to her family, and her family kind of took care of me at that point. Mm-hmm. But we had walked into a Holiday Inn that was having a jewelry auction. So we're in this, and I was like, this is kind of cool. I've never been to a jewelry auction. Everybody was in suits and stuff. So I'm like, you know, let's do something cool. So we went back and got nicer clothes on, a tie, and we came back there and got a little card, and we were sitting there at 18, 19 years old, and we started auctioning off this nice big ring. And so I held up the card a couple times, and pretty soon I owned a ring. And she gave me a big old hug, and the whole place erupted in cheers, and it was actually kind of fun.
Did you get down on a knee right there?
No, I just hit it for a while. She didn't know. I figured I still gotta wait, make her sweat a while, but she knew I had one.
Yeah, looking back now, we're almost 50 at this point and been married almost 30 years. And I would say that was a period of time in our lives where even though we thought we were independent, we were both still pretty immature when it came to relationships. So I can remember times of conflict that we did not handle well. And I remember one time in particular, John came home from work, grabbed his duffel bag, and said, "See ya, I'm going to California, or I'm going to Colorado with the guys." And I said, "Now what now?" And so then a car full of four guys drove up and ready to go to Colorado with John. And I basically took my wedding ring off and said, I threw it at him and said, "Well, if you're not going to communicate with me about where you're going, then you can take this with you."
Wow. And wow.
I don't like necessarily that happened, but I do think it's important for people to know that even though we loved each other, there were times of conflict, and we didn't always handle conflict perfectly well.
Yeah. And I think my response was why we're still together and how I dealt with that situation in such a great manner, because I ran out to the guys and jumped in the back seat, and they're like, "She's really mad." I'm like, "Yeah, drive. She's really mad. Get out of here. Go, go, go." So we drove off and we went to Colorado before cell phones.
We might not recommend that to younger couples today, but you know, each to their own.
It worked.
Okay. So you guys have been married 30 years. What would you say is the secret to lasting that long?
Well, we're not quite there yet. No. What would you say?
One thing, we laugh a lot together, and we enjoy each other's company, and we like to do things together. Mm-hmm. And we compromise on what we like to do. That's a big thing. You know, I like to run, she likes to walk. So we go hiking together. We meet in the middle a lot of times. And so,
Yeah, compromise is a big deal.
I like to camp. She likes to travel. So we stay in Hilton's. So that kind of thing.
There's a lot of compromise.
There's a lot of compromise every day. There's some.
And I think that it's just dedication. It's dedication to marriage, because we have never, ever, well, just that one incident with a ring, but we have never, ever talked about separation or divorce. That's not an option in our marriage. And so I think just focusing on just trying to be selfless and focusing on the needs of that you have, instead of only thinking about my own needs and wanting him to become the best version of himself. And I think that's what just keeps me going, is when I see him grow, when I see him flourish, that's just genuinely thrilling for me. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That's cool. So let's talk a little bit about your work life and what you guys, you know, do. And, you know, specifically, it just is interesting, you know, that takes up a lot of our time, you know, in the day, you know, work. Was it something that you always, and you guys could share what you guys do, but is it something that you always felt led by the Lord to do? Have you always wanted to engage in the work that you do? Talk to me a little bit about that, and what does it look like to follow Jesus in your profession?
You want to go first?
No, go ahead.
So I went to college to be an engineer, and turns out that there's like math involved and like chemistry, so that didn't work out so well. And her grandfather, who was who was an awesome man, said, you know, I see something that I think you would be interested in. And his neighbor was a police officer in Ottawa County. And so he made it so I could ride with him for the day. I'd never met the guy, but I went and showed up. And back then it was easier. You could jump in a cruiser and ride with a police officer and just see what they were doing. And I did that. And we had a couple of really hot calls that we would call them bigger incidents. And then a little later in the day, riding that day, we had an accident with injuries. And I showed up and it was Emily was in the car accident.
Wow.
And we helped them out of the car accident and took the report, made sure everybody was okay. And by then we had been running lights and sirens for most of the day. And I'm like, engineering, why would anyone go into engineering? This is awesome. The adrenaline dumps and the and helping people. And because we had a couple of medicals that day where you're helping people with broken legs. And so then I realized that, wow, this job is really cool. And that's when I started looking at police work, and it was much, much better of a fit than engineering. Yes. And so I've been a police officer for almost 30 years now. So with the police department with Holland.
How do you, you know, you come across some difficult situations and, you know, even coming up above on accidents and you see some hard stuff and physically, but also even emotionally, relationally, you know, when you get into some situations and you see a lot of brokenness, you know, in our world, how do you, what does it look like to bring your relationship with Jesus into those areas? You know, what do you try to do in those times?
You know, I think it's made my job easier because you do have faith and you do trust in God when you do things, whether it's a SWAT raid or undercover operations or I am very, very blessed to work for the city of Holland. People don't understand how awesome that police force is for the city. And I've worked all over the country with different police forces in what I do for the Holland Police Department. And to have a group of individuals that do Bible studies together and SWAT teams that pray before they make an entry or deal with a hostage situation or just changes your outlook on your job. And I can't even imagine being in other departments that didn't have that. But I've never experienced that because it's always been that way in Holland. And I'm very lucky. And so, you know, some of the major drug dealers that I've dealt with have come to church with me later and sat down with my family. We've seen a lot of the people I work with coming into church on different occasions. And I've always felt that I treat everybody like they're my brother. So if they were my brother or sister, how would I want them to be treated by the police? That's how I'll treat you. And sometimes I felt like my brother or sister, my sister would need discipline and or my children, you know, so you treat them that way in those occasions, but otherwise they were always treated that I would want my family to be treated like. That has worked for me over the years because I don't have a lot of people that I have trouble with, you know.
What was it like the first time you showed up at church and saw somebody that you had more of a professional interaction with the previous day or two?
This is a good story because we were sitting in church and our kids were with us. And right in front of us, pew in front of us, was a gentleman that I had met because I had arrested him for homicide just a couple days before. And he was in the pew in front of my family. And I talked to him for quite a while in church that day and just how was he doing and how is what the outcome's going to be kind of. And we hit it off and it actually helped me through the rest of the job. And I think helped him, you know, I could see that he was really trying. Yeah, we've run into a few people over the days that way.
You know, it's interesting in my interaction with people who have had trouble with the law. Just, you know, they make mistakes just like we make mistakes. You know, theirs have, you know, consequences that are a little bit more visual. But, you know, at the end of the day, it comes to having that softness of heart. And I've seen I've been always impressed when people would have that softness of heart, regardless of what they've done. it's like, all right, we'll walk together because we're both in the same boat, you know, and we both made mistakes and we need the grace and the love of Jesus, you know? And so it's when you get past that, what they did, and it's like, okay, let's get to know one another. You know, it's, yeah, it's powerful. So Emily, you see John pulling up in that cruiser. And what was that? That would have had to have been interesting.
Yeah, it's been interesting to be a law enforcement officer's wife over the years. And the thing is, he loves his work and he's passionate about his work. And that's one area where I can support him and encourage him to love others well. So yeah, there are days that I have more concern than others, days that he's perhaps gone for 2 or 3 days at a time because of a violent crime or some type of drug deal. But overall, every morning, it's just turning him over to the Lord and saying, I can't control what the future holds, but I know that Jesus does. And so I think just like with any other serious relationship in my life, like, yeah, I recognize where my limits are and just trust that God will sustain us. Yep. No matter what. So
you spend your days helping people from a different perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talk to us about that.
Sure. So my work is a counselor at Winning at Home. And Winning at Home is a faith-based counseling organization right here in West Michigan. And my role specifically is to serve children and adolescents. I absolutely love my work. I see each child and adolescent that comes in as just full of God-given strengths and abilities. And sometimes things that happen in life can diminish or cover those really sweet God-given abilities. And so I love working with kids to help them find their potential. And so whether it's anxiety or depression or attention issues or relationship issues or whatever it happens to be, it's a privilege to sit with kids and families and help them discern who they are and find their identity in Christ. So I've been doing that now for 17 years at Winning at Home. And then before that, I worked at Holland Hospital in their emergency department and outpatient services. And so I've been a counselor now for 25 years.
Wow.
And I still absolutely love it.
Wow, that's awesome.
Thanks.
You, you've also spent some time in Africa, right? Haven't you traveled over there and done some work?
Yeah, so part of my role at Winning at Home is to oversee our program called Winning at Home World. And Winning at Home World travels to different locations over throughout the globe. One of our strongest partners is in Zambia. And so usually once a year, I make it out to Zambia, and we have a ministry where we're teaching lay counselors how to counsel kids that have been orphaned or who are vulnerable for various reasons. And that has been probably one of the highlights in my career. We've been in Zambia and working on right now partnerships in Rwanda and Lesotho. Guatemala is a strong partner right now. And so part of my role too is to serve missionaries and missionary kids overseas. And I have kind of a personal connection with missionary kids. So I get them.
Yeah, you get them. That's funny.
Ouch.
And I love the third culture kid experience and just being able to support them in ways when they're in foreign countries. So
yeah. That's just a huge opportunity and just a huge like whole area, because having talked with kids who were missionary kids or are missionary kids, and that third culture when they born and raised in maybe the United States, and then they spend some time in the other parts of the world, you know, for an extended time, but yet they're not, you know, that culture, and they're not necessarily American anymore. It's like, where do I fit? What, you know, who exactly am I? And it's some great opportunity, I'm sure, to speak a true identity in Christ. Into
exactly. Them. Yeah. And I have a little wanderlust spirit myself. So I love the travel part of it too, visiting missionaries all around the globe. So
you guys are always on vacation. You guys are always taking off.
It's she calls it work. It's work.
John's like, nope, that's not work. I'm done working.
Yeah, we love to travel quite a bit.
So I want to end on this conversation, and I'm curious where this is going to go, because John, you work in law enforcement in this area. Emily, you engage in conversations with a ton of, you know, teenagers and people, you know, in this area. What would you say are the biggest needs in West Michigan, in the Holland and Zeeland area? We did not prep for this question.
We didn't, but we didn't prep for any of the questions, so it's all good.
You know, in my job, the thing that I see most prevalent is the breakdown of the family and the single parent homes. And it just doesn't seem like the kids that are brought up in those homes get the equal treatment or the best of society growing up like that. And in my job, I think that a lot of the people I dealt with, it's not always the incident that we meet at. It's usually a long history of things that have happened in their life that brought them to that point.
Yeah. And I would say it's been really interesting over the past year with the pandemic, with COVID, because, you know, even when I met with kids pre-pandemic, even when they were depressed and they were anxious, there was this general trajectory toward hopefulness for the future. And if one of the things that the pandemic has brought, along with a lot of physical illness, is just this sense of chronic disappointment and this trajectory toward hopelessness that I've seen in our teens. And it's really, really sad because it's just pervasive and it leads to severe depression and, you know, a huge increase in suicide rates in the past year in Ottawa County. So if I could say the complicated answer to your question is hope. People need hope, but the simple answer is Jesus. Right. I mean, I thought, can I just say that and be finished with the question? Because, you know, when you know, when you have that internal, that intrinsic sense of hope that doesn't come from your circumstances, that makes all the difference. And you can get through, like we had talked about earlier, you can get through adversity, you can get through pandemics when you have that stability of hope in your life. So I would say hope in Jesus.
So how can people in the church be carriers of that hope in light of Jesus? You know, there's that need. People need hope. You know, people need Jesus. You know, as you guys engage, like how can the church engage in this community in that way? You know, where do you see the opportunities for us?
Yeah, that's one of the things I love most about being a part of Restoration Church is that it's a church in action. And as much as we see transformation on Sunday mornings and worship services have been awesome, by the way, I have also see a body of believers ready for action. And they're not content to sit in a chair on Sunday morning and be passive. They have been active in meeting with people, building relationships, offering food, offering transportation, just loving people well. And when they see a need, they communicate about it and they work on filling the need. And I think that's what makes a body operate well. And I love being a part of Restoration because of that.
I absolutely agree. And that the whole church and the people here spreading hope and Jesus is definitely the catalyst of what the church is doing. And to watch them do that without any judgment on the people you talk to, that's a big deal.
It's like the last place that people want to be at Restoration Church is in a chair, you know, sitting down. They're like, who can I pray for? Who can I talk with? You know, it definitely is a group of people that are ready for action. And it's all motivated by the hope and the love of Jesus. Well, thanks, guys. You know, John, I don't know why it is. Like, every time you're going to open up your mouth, I knew I was going to laugh, you know, whether it was laughing at you or laughing at a story, you know. So
we'll just stick with those stories for now. There's a few more.